Members, my youngest son is here today. Isaac is sitting back here. Isaac's 13 and a 7th grader, and McCray has spring break this week, so he's been here all week. Some of you have probably seen him wandering around here. Yeah, really. Yeah, he's at 13, he spends spring break here, so. Yes. Okay. Say, members, last week Representative Gardner was good enough to let us take his bill off the agenda. It's on the agenda this week, and this week he's sick. So I'm going to take the committee's guidance on this. I would like to move the bill, even if he's not here, but if there's no objection from the committee, I think we'll go ahead and do that. Mr. Cleary offered to explain the bill. So if it's okay with everybody, I think we'll go ahead and do that. Okay, I'll move the bill then. It's House File 1286. I move that the bill be passed with recommendation and moved to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. And Mr. Cleary, if you would present the bill for us, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill would extend privileges under game and fish law. Under current law, certain veterans are entitled to a free annual license to take fish by angling, to take deer by firearm or archery, and to take small game. And those veterans are those who are 100% permanently and totally disabled for service-connected reasons, as determined by the Department of Veterans Affairs. This bill would extend that benefit to those who are receiving a pension from the USVA, who are totally and permanently disabled for other than service connected reasons. There are actually relatively few people receiving that benefit, and I'm not sure how many. I didn't prepare to speak to the bill this morning, but To be eligible for a pension, a person has to essentially be indigent and also must have served during a time of war. It's not necessary. Of course, remember, we're talking about a disability that's not service-connected. So, for example, if an old veteran like myself happens to have a heart attack and become indigent, which my wife keeps warning me is quite possible. One would become eligible for this, having served in a combat area. Actually, it doesn't even have to be a combat area. It just has to be during a time of war or hostilities. If you notice on the bill summary, I've listed on the back some information that I pulled off the VA website that shows that it shows what the means test is. If you're a veteran with no dependents, just a single veteran, your yearly income must be less than $11,830 for you to receive any pension. So let's say a veteran in that situation who served during time of combat and had a total disability, was not able to work because of this disability, and the disability was not service-connected. Let's say that veteran was earning $5,000 today doing some part-time work, or say on some investment income. You would take the $11,830 minus $5,000, and the remainder would be the amount that the person's pension from the VA. So these people would be awarded given the benefit of the free licenses to hunt and fish. My expectation would be that there'd be very little fiscal notes for this bill. I don't know that one has been prepared, but I think it would be very small because, after all, these are 100% disabled folks who are probably not buying many of these licenses today. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Cleary? Representative Detmer.
And Mr. Chairman, yes, this is very similar to the bill that we passed through the committee last, in terms of state parks, yeah. The total disabled veterans getting waiving the fee for state parks. So this is very similar to that, and I am assuming that DNR is supportive of this also, this bill also. Is there someone from the DNR here? Or?
That's a, yeah, if there is, I don't know, I guess. Oh, okay, good, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Cleary described the bill very well. There is a slight fiscal impact right now. We're estimating about currently disabled licenses. We estimate about $75,000 impact. Then there's going to be a federal aid loss, but certainly we can deal with that as we move through the process. It wouldn't be any general fund-related issues. It's just loss of the game of fish funds. So that's just something that you folks can decide and deal with. It's minimal at best, but there is a small impact.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Meyer?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah. Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, any further questions for Mr. Cleary from members? All right, I'll renew my motion that House File 1286 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. All right, Representative Leader, your bill. And Representative Leader, welcome to your committee. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 980 be recommended to pass, and I believe Mr. Chair, does that go to the floor?
Yes, and it'll be referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there's also an amendment, and we just received the amendment, and actually what the amendment done, it's a technical amendment, and it came over from the Senate. And Mr. Cleary, if you look at it, the numbers don't match up, but the language is okay. But so there'd be a problem with the amendment, not with the amendment, I imagine in engrossment, you pick it up because the numbers, there's a deletion in one part, but that's also in another section of the bill, and that's why it was deleted in that one line. Mr. Chair, I didn't move the amendment, but I can move the amendment A90902.05. If Mr. Cleary,
okay,
has some comments.
Mr. Cleary.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to work out the numbers here if you would like to discuss the bill first.
Okay, and Mr. Cleary, you were talking about taking care of this later.
If you'd like to discuss for another moment or so, I'll just work out the numbers.
Okay, that's good. We'll just wait a few minutes on the amendment and Representative Leader, and go ahead and talk about the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, this bill deals with the eligibility for applicants for the peace officers exam, the post board has that exam. That's for licensed peace officers. They can't be called a peace officer unless they have that permit or not certificate or whatever you want to call it, to graduate basically from an academy, a military academy, or have some other law enforcement training. What this bill does, it expands the statute. The old statute that provided that a military veteran that had military police service of 5 years could be eligible for the exam, and it had to be, he had to be a, the, not he, he or she had to be a graduate of a military academy in law enforcement. What this bill would do would allow that if they had 3 years of military experience and graduated from an exam and had also a post, 2 years postgraduate, they'd be eligible to take this exam. It doesn't make them a police officer. It just allows for the eligibility to take the exam, the post-exam. And that's basically a slight change because that allows military, ex-military personnel to at least become police officers. There's actually a shortage of people that take the exam, also in law enforcement, and this acknowledges the previous military experiences. It actually enlarges the pool for in civilian employee, for civilian employment. And Mr. Chair, I have testifiers here that would testify to that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Leader. And go ahead, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Michelle Puckner from the State Patrol. This is one of our agency initiative bills that we're moving forward. What the bill basically does and what Representative Leader stated was that currently the statute states 5 years military specialty experience, and most enlistment periods are 4 years, and so we're missing a pool of people that we feel that if we present this language with the 3 years military and 2 years post-secondary education, we can expand our pool of potential candidates. In addition, I think the bill does a nice job of trying to offer those veterans that are returning home some more job opportunities.
All right, thank you. Representative Detmer.
Okay, so that, Mr. Chair, and either testifier, Representative Leader, or the testifier. Currently, the statute reads you need to have 5 years of active duty military police experience. Now, during those 5 years, are these soldiers, I'm not sure if it's included in their AIT training, but do they attend the military academy during their AIT training?
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, I don't know if it's at that time when initially, but sometime in their career, they have to have some academy, I presume, before they become a military.
Because I know they do their basic training, then they go to their AIT, which would be your military police MOS. Is the academy part of that training, or do they have to spend so many years in their MOS before they qualify for the academy?
Mr. Chair, the post board is here. They're the ones that look at those requirements and make certain that the people who are applying under this reciprocity meet the requirements. They may be able to speak to that. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Burkholm. I'm the Legislative and Rules Coordinator with the Minnesota Post Board. And Representative Benmer, I can try to answer your question. Basically, what the Post Board looks at when we are looking at applications for a military reciprocity peace officer exam is the DD-214 form. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah.
I think you are. And we would look for what their occupation was, and we would require it to be military police, and it would be 5 years under current law, and then that they had an honorable discharge. And that's about it. As far as the academy goes, the main requirement that we have is just that they've been trained in military policing and that they did fulfill 5 years in that capacity. So does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, that's current statute.
Right.
Okay, so what we're doing, we're adding wording in terms of an academy. My question was, have they taken that academy while they're on active duty or as a reservist? Is that academy part of their training that's required by the military?
I don't believe I'm able to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody from military affairs would be here. The way the Post Board would interpret this law is we wouldn't necessarily look at did they graduate from a military service law enforcement academy? It would be, did they have 5 years of active service experience or 3 years with a 2-year degree?
Mr. Chair, but the way it is worded in the new language is that they will have to have graduated from a military police academy. Now, if that's the AIT, that's fine. But if it's not, we have to look at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Colonel Aldis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Colonel Eric Aldis, Department of Military Affairs. The post board, that was their language as we looked at it. The reason they use the military academy because not all services such as the Army refer to it as an advanced individual training, but that would be considered the academy from the Army perspective. The Navy uses different vocabulary that more aligns with it. That's why they use the more general term, but the individual training requirement would complete the academy requirements according to this statute in discussions with the agency.
Well, Mr. Chair. So the AIT, Advanced Individualized Training, in the Army anyway, is the military academy then, that they would, and then they go to their duty station and their military police. Okay, thank you.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this issue, I think the 5 years active military experience was an effort to enlarge the pool, give the individuals that have been serving in a military capacity in the service the ability to just take the exam. And so part of what we're doing here that I see is we are now restricting that opportunity. And the way I'm reading this is we are, as Representative Detmer was saying, we're putting in another ingredient that basically says you have to successfully complete an academy or that type of training. I'm sorry, maybe she wants to respond.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think if I read the statute, what we've done here, we've given another option. We've left that language in as well. I think under number 3, 5 years cumulative experience as a full-time police officer in other states combined with active service military. As I understood that language, either 5 years military or that combined with the law enforcement piece. You didn't have to be a peace officer in other states. It could be the 5 years military, that was still there, and that we were trying to expand by adding clause 1 and 2 for some other options.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
If I could ask Mr. Clear to give me some clarification. Because I read 3 and I say 5 years cumulative experience as a full-time peace officer in another state combined with active service experience in military law enforcement occupational specialty. We've just added on the requirement that now they have to have served in another state in a full-time peace officer capacity in order to qualify for that 5 years of military experience. So I think we've just complicated the issue here.
Representative.
I think Representative Severson, the word or precedes that, and that takes care of that, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair. Not the way I read it. Maybe we'll get some clarification from
Mr. Clary. Clary. Mr. Chairman and Representative Severson and members, I think you're both correct here in that, A, the bill does add another requirement. The plain language suggests they have to graduate from an academy. Now, there might be some danger that a future administrator, long after all of us are gone, would interpret that to mean some sort of a formal academy other than AIT. Even if your intent right now is just AIT, perhaps some other language here could signify just AIT. But in addition, it does add, as Testfire said, it does add another option. The option would be for 3 years of such experience as well as graduation from a completion of a two-year degree. So it both adds another option and another requirement.
Okay. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And may I add one more thing? I just remembered. Representative Severson, on line 116, I call your attention to OR. And consequently, it would not be necessary that they do number 3, 5 years experience in another state, but that would be yet another option.
OR. Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I understand that, but what we've done in the first line, in A, we've struck out the 5 years of active duty police service. That is no longer in the statute, and we've replaced it with 5 years of cumulative experience as a full-time peace officer in another state, combined with active service experience in military law enforcement occupational. So you could have somebody who's got 3 years of experience in law enforcement in another state with 2 years of active duty experience that would qualify. But we put in the proviso that that has to be from another state that no longer allows for the individual who has 5 years of active duty experience just in the military. Maybe I'm reading this wrong, but that I think we could clarify this language if we struck the language, the verbiage that's taken out, 5 years of active duty experience, if the intent of this bill is to be all-inclusive and increase the pool of applicants going to the job, being able to take the exam. I think that would be a simple fix.
Mr. Chair.
So it represents Detmer.
If I'm looking at this right, if we would just reinstate the original language, we've covered it because they've had 5 years of active duty military police experience. They've completed their AIT, which is a military academy. So they've met all the requirements just in that sentence A, or 1-9. That would meet all the requirements that the other ones have are asking for, because you've had 5 years of active duty military police service. You graduated from AIT, which is the academy, so you met all the requirements, and then you would go down, which 117, which was in an addition, you have 5 years cumulative experience as a full-time peace officer in another state, combined with active service experience in a military law enforcement occupation specialty. So we're just allowing someone from another state to come in that have had that experience too. And another thing that's been added is the 2 year or more degree. That's something new too. Okay.
Mr. Chair, our intention, I see what everybody's saying, and I would agree that it sounds, Clause 3 was supposed to say 5 years, but it could be 5 years military service as it was originally stated, or the combination of 5 years, 3 years military service, 2 years as a peace officer in another state, a combination. I can see, though, by the way it's worded, that it might be construed that you had to have both. And so it wasn't intended to eliminate what language was already there, the 5 year active military service. It was meant to give that as an option, or a combination of that, 3 years military, 2 years peace officer somewhere else, or vice versa. I'm not certain that I have the language fixed for you on that, though.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, if the author be willing to take just an oral amendment on this, I think it could be very easily fixed just by eliminating the stricken language, 5 years of active military service, reinstate that, and then make those additional provisos under 1.11, I think would fix the issue. Then it doesn't exclude someone who has 5 years of military service, but is inclusive, and then the extra provisos are on there.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I'd like to ask Mr. Cleary, because if you look at the amendment, that maybe has an impact on it too. I think the concern is in that first paragraph, you're defining relevant military experience, because that's defined in Section 190.05, and I'd like to ask Mr. Cleary just to clear this one up for us.
Yes, Mr. Cleary.
Members, I'll be honest with you, I don't hear very well, and so I don't always understand.
Mr. Chair, including Mr. Cleary, the question is, with the in the bill, on line 1.9 and 1.10, the deleted language is 5 years he wants to reinstate the deleted language, basically what it is. Yes. And I'm wondering if there's an impact from the amendment where it says active service has a meaning given in Section 190.5, if that has anything to do with the definition of relevant military experience.
Yes.
Either way, I just want to get it cleared up. I think we're kind of getting pretty nitpicky on this, because I could also ask military police, all military police, unless they've trained, don't go through the academy. I think they have enlisted men that don't go through the academy, and they're called military police. So I think we're kind of getting refined here, and Mr. Cleary could clear this up.
Mr. Cleary.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, starting with line 1.22 and 2.3, active service has a meaning given in 190.05 subdivision 5. Well, subdivision 5 includes federal active service, which the feds call active duty, which would correspond with line 110. That's federal active service. It also includes federally funded state active service, for example, being called out to the airport for an extended period of time under federal funding, but serving here within the state. And then it also includes state active service, which is what soldiers do when they're tending to floods and tornadoes and so on. So active service is defined fairly broadly. But for all practical purposes, you would only serve 5 years of that type of service in federal active duty. So there's not really a difference. And then if I could, perhaps there's a question on that.
Representative Severson, did you have something first? I know you had your hand up a little bit.
Just a point, Mr. Chair and Representative Leader. I think when this originally came out, it was just a few years ago that we enacted this. The issue was, if we have military people who have served 5 years in the capacity of a law enforcement capacity within the military service, regardless of what kind of other type of training they've had, we want to give them the opportunity to take the exam. Now, they may not pass the exam, and my understanding is there's probably a number of them that don't, simply because they don't have the background in the state policies in order to pass this, and they're going to need some help. But that aside, the intent of the bill was to increase the pool, give them the opportunity, just give them the opportunity to take the exam. And now what we're doing with this bill is we're basically ramping down the criteria to try and constrain some individuals who may not meet that open gate to take the exam. This does not say that they're going to get the job. This merely says that they have the opportunity to take the exam.
Mr. Chair, if the problem is we can just reinstate the language, I don't think it, and they don't think it makes any difference to the bill, but if that satisfies the committee, that's fine. Reinstate the original language.
Okay, Representative Detmer has something to say.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Leader. When you look at active duty military service, is this a cumulative active duty because you have reservists and National Guard that are called to active duty and it shows up on their DD-214 that they've had this many months? Is it a cumulative active duty service, or do you have to have it all in a five-year period continuous? That would come up too, because you could have, we have reservists and National Guards now that are called up for 2 years, and maybe another down the road another year, and so forth, and they might be military police. And Representative Leader, your question about the academy, we just indicated in the committee here that AIT is the academy, so in the Army, anyway, anybody that completed their AIT have done the academy. Otherwise, if they don't complete their AIT, they're not in the military. That's it. They didn't make the grade. So we can assume that everybody has done the academy if they've done AIT. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. I believe that is true, and Military Affairs could speak better to that. But we would be fine with striking the requirement under successful graduation from a military service law enforcement academy if that would make things better for the committee. Because we're assuming that everyone who is serving in a military law enforcement occupational specialty has been through that, as Representative Detmer stated.
And
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Mr. Chairman. And one other point here that we need to look at under 1.13, that whole paragraph down to 1.15, a two-year or more degree. Then we go to 3. Now, how do we know that person from another state has completed a two-year degree or not? Because it wouldn't require under 3.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, This language was actually mirrored after the Post Board policy for state-to-state reciprocity.
Okay.
And we do not require peace officers from another state to have a two-year degree. They must go through their academy system or whatever was required in their state to become a peace officer. We are just trying to give more options for people coming back from the service to become eligible to take the peace officer exam.
Okay. Are you finished? Okay, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've got a solution here. If Mr. Cleary could put this together, and I think it would be to, on line 1.9, at the end of that line, it would be for the purposes of this section, relevant military service means, and then put on the second line, reinstate the language, 5 years of active military service, police service, or, and that would be subparagraph one, and then subparagraph two would be the following 1.11, and replace the one with a two, and then subsequent after that. So what we're doing is we are making it inclusive of the existing language and just another condition. So we're adding on the conditions that have been amended onto this this bill, and then just reinstating the language as an original position, and it just opens up the opportunity, which I think is the intent of the author, if I'm correct.
Mr. Chair, I think I should withdraw this, because that really causes a problem for Mr. Cleary. We've got a lot of things going, and I think it's confused him thoroughly, and me too, because I think the intent of the bill, everybody agrees on that, but we're getting locked into semantics here that it's pretty hard for Mr. Cleary, I think, to pick it up right now.
Mr. Cleary, actually, Representative Leader, I think I did understand that. But may I offer another interpretation here? I'm sorry, ma'am. Your name is?
Myself, Michelle Buckner, and this is Jennifer.
Yes. You had suggested we could drop the language successful graduation from Military Law Enforcement Academy. If that language were dropped, Representative Severson, in line 1.11 and 1.13, if that language were deleted, the current clause 1 would read 5 years active duty experience in a military law enforcement occupational specialty, which is essentially the same thing as your, and I think it's a little cleaner. So I see everybody nodding yes. Mr. Chairman, I would state that amendment as follows. On line 1.19, I would leave that alone and not reinstate the language. Also on line 1.110, I would leave that stricken language alone, not reinstate it. On line 1.111, I would simply delete the new language, a successful graduation from a military service law enforcement academy and. And then on line 13, one would delete the new language, successful graduation from military service law enforcement academy, comma. So then the entire language would read, starting on 1.9a, for purposes of this section, relevant military experience means, one, 5 years active service experience in a military law enforcement occupational specialty, two, 3 years active service experience in a law enforcement occupational specialty and completion of a two-year or more degree from a regionally accredited post-secondary educational institution, or, and then three would stay the same. I see a lot of thumbs up.
Looks good.
Okay, Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Cleary? We don't need the amendment then.
The Senate amendment? That's correct, Representative Leader. We would not need that Senate amendment.
I'll move to I move the amendment on that. What I got to do, I'm going to take it off.
Okay, Representative Leader withdraws the motion to approve Amendment AO9-0205. Okay.
Then I think we're okay, Mr. Clear.
Okay, and Representative Leader moves the oral amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Detmer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Leader, thank you for bringing this to our committee. We got it squared away. Good to go. You're good to go.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think the intent is what was really with the bill, and I think we got it pretty well refined. So I would hope that the members would support it.
Okay. Any further discussion to the oral amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now to the
renewal representative. The House File 980 as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Veterans and Agriculture.
The Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economy, and Veterans Affairs. Yeah. Okay, any further discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Leader. All right, next on the agenda, House File 1884, Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you taking some time in your committee to hear from us. I have with me today Carrie and Elise Maggett. They have been my inspiration for this bill that I'm bringing forward to you today.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, too, Representative Anderson. Do you want us to move your bill? Should we go ahead?
Yes,
okay.
If you would.
Anybody? Representative Severson moves House File 1884 recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. Okay, thank you, and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, these two ladies have been the inspiration for this piece of legislation. I first came across them during the Plymouth Parade in my legislative district. Here, Elise was sitting up on a horse that was probably 10 feet taller than me, it seemed like. And she was in full control and command and confident of her mission. She's part of One Girl, One Ride. This is her mission that she has come up with. And I'll let her speak to more about it. But I'll tell you, my husband actually had a conversation with them at the parade, and he was so excited after talking to them. He said, you know, Sarah, we need to make sure that we donate to them. Well, as things go and you get caught up in the campaign, you forget about those things. But lo and behold, they scheduled an appointment at my office and came into my office, and I said, you know what, I remember you guys. And I think it was destiny in getting this project going. And from that visit that we had, I put together this bill. What they are interested in doing is putting together a camp, a horse ranch in particular, for veterans to give them a place to relax, to heal, and to, if they want to, share their experience with other veterans and just give them a positive experience, especially considering what they put on the line for us to protect our freedom. And so this is all the brainchild here of Elise. From that, what I've done is this legislation gets the ball rolling for this horse ranch. It asks the DNR to designate state vacant land that we have for this horse ranch. I've had conversations with the Department of Natural Resources. I've also talked to the Department of Veterans Affairs, a legislative liaison, also with Dean Ashman, the state commander for the disabled veterans group. And so this is just kind of the first step in this process, and we're just hoping that you can look favorably on it today. But before I get into any more of the specifics of it, I want you to hear from Elise.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and give us your name, please.
My name's Elise. My mom's Gary.
We need last name, too.
Oh, Maggett Menorita. and I'm 12 years old, and I ride a horse named Tip. And last summer, I rode 86 days and over 860 miles to support our military and their family. I want to build a ranch where any soldier in need of a place to heal can go for free. August of 2007, my mom and I took a trip to the Grand Canyon. And in southern Colorado, I started seeing large American flags on large country mailboxes. I asked my mom what they were about because it wasn't like a holiday or anything. So my mom said it must be proud parents of their children in the military. Then my mom added, if your brothers or sister, if you had brothers or sisters who were in the military, I would have the biggest flag you could get. About 100 miles later, I told her that I wanted to do something. My mom said two things. First, you better be passionate about what you do. And second, you better do what you're going to do. You can't tell families of sons and daughters in harm's way that you're going to do something and then just quit. Well, to me, when my mom said passion, my horse popped right into my mind. And then the ranch idea just came to me. I know how good I feel on a warm Minnesota night riding trip. And I knew if our servicemen and women were given a chance to step back to a gentler time where you just heard nature, like a horse snicker, a cow moo, or an owl hoot at night, maybe they could relax and reconnect, or even meet up with their buddies from their service. The ranch will not be fancy. In fact, it'll be humble, just like the men and women that serve our country. My ride started on June 7, 2008. We went to Duluth, over to Bemidji, down to Park Rapids, across to Walker, down to Brainerd, to Camp Ripley, where we stayed for 2 days while they let me train in multiple weapons, fly a helicopter, eat in the mess hall, field backwash of technical landings of transport planes, and sleep in the Sergeant Major's house. We moved to Long Ferry, where my mom and I spent our summers as a child. Over to St. Cloud, down through Cold Spring, Richmond, Painesville, South Haven, Hutchinson, Winthrop, Gaylord, New Ulm, St. Peter, Mankato, over to Faribault, Owatonna, Claremont, up to Cannon Falls, Denver Grove Heights, to finish at the Capitol in St. Paul on August 31st. I proudly rode with Posse, Mounted Patrol, Sheriff's Department, police, veterans of wars from World War II to Iraq, and Grandpa's salute who immigrated to America with $125 in his pocket and became the American dream. Everywhere we rode, people told us we needed this place for our brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, fathers, and mothers who have served our country to go to heal, reconnect with their family, meet up with the people that they served with, and talk about their shared experiences. My mom told me when she called the police in Melrose to tell them that we were soon going to come to their city limits and that we were ready to be brought through their town, and then she spoke to Judy Weber. Officer Weber and my mom talked about the ride and the idea of the ranch, and my mom said the line went quiet. My mom said yes if she was there. Officer Weber said she shouldn't be crying, but that her daughter was a Marine and had served 2 tours in Iraq. Officer Weber told my mom that her daughter really needed the ranch. My mom said that she was writing Judy's name in her journal, and that when the ranch was built, that her daughter could come see her mother's name in the journal and know that she had helped build the ranch. I don't really need to tell you how wonderful Minnesota is, but let me tell you how the ride works. My mom and I would arrive in a town like Horrocks. The refugee restaurant and bar would let us put chips in their baseball field they owned while we slept in our truck and trailer. In Princeton, the chief of police called a friend of his, the Rutherfords, and they put us up and put chip in a beautiful field. Jim and Joyce Johnson kept us for 2 days, where we met their granddaughter, Sydney, as she was holding an apple in a check for one girl, one ride. Chip really enjoyed the apple. While her and her brothers, Dylan, Wade, and the four-wheeler, we've now become really good friends. In Ogilvie, three women, Denise, Andy, Tia, and... waited for us at the gas station and invited us to stay at their house and then rode with me the next day. Irv Feeling, a full-blooded Ojibwe Indian and Posse member, took us into Powwow, where I was blessed by Chief Greeting Spear and awarded 2 eagle feathers, got to lead an honor dance, and then was given an honor blanket with tobacco and money. In Steele County, a Steele County Posse member and Vietnam vet Mike Hines rode with me for 9 days as he took us in while we racked up miles to move down the road. One of our new best friends is a Wadena County Posse member, Fran Kruger. He spent days and weeks calling police, sheriff, posse members to ride with me and keep me safe. John, I call him Grandpa Flute now, sat tall in the saddle as we rode through Winthrop beside his granddaughter in our small parade through his town. Grandpa wiped his eyes as he said it was the proudest moment of his life to ride with the flag. One Girl, One Ride worked because the people in Minnesota wanted it to work. It opened their hearts to strangers to help build the ranch. Each town or city limit sign we came to, my mom would take out the United States flag and pass it over Kip's face to remind him it was there. I would carry it while I rode through town. It can be a long ride riding through a town on a hot day with carrying a flag. But that was Kip's favorite day of the day, quitting time. At some point in each town or city we passed through, the newspapers and local TV stations would interview me. Last summer was long and hot. I loved the sheriffs and deputies, police chiefs, and officers that would buy me Dairy Queen at the end of the day. I am proud and honored to ride for our servicemen and women, but my job will not be done until the ranch is built and the first man or woman checks in. That is why I'm here today. Please help me build the ranch. We would like 1,000 acres or 600 acres to get about state park land that we can ride into. The ranch needs to be safe and secluded for our servicemen and women. I have had a great opportunity to meet with you and become friends with most of you. And I want you to know that your support and encouragement means a great deal to me. I will start my ride again Saturday, June 6, 2009, here at the state capitol at 9 o'clock in the morning. Over 1,000 riders will leave the capitol and ride 20.7 miles to Plymouth, where I live. I hope all of you can be there to come, send us along, ride a bike or a horse, take a ride in one of the wagons, or join us in Plymouth around 4 o'clock in the afternoon for the finish. We're going to show the world that Minnesota cares about our servicemen and women. My brother Blake found a story about giving back in a small way to those who serve. There is a line at the end that says it all. A veteran is someone who one point in his life wrote a blank check made payable to the United States for an amount up to and including my life. The ranch is such a small gift for our servicemen and women, but it is such a needed place. Thank you for your support and time today.
All right, thank you. Good job. We appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, if we could also, Carrie wanted to give more of the detail to the organization.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm Carrie Madgett, Elise's mom. Just a couple of business orders I wanted to get out of the way right away is that we are a 501c, and we do have a full board of 12 members that include business owners, a veterinarian from Anoka Equine, a lawyer, and a retired DNR officer. So we've really tried to look for people that, when this ranch is built, that have a kind of a blending of people that will have skills and talents and gifts that they will bring to this as far as our information that we need to get out. Thank you. Thank you for your invitation to speak to you today. Elise and I are very honored to be here. I would like to tell you a little bit about Elise that she will never tell you. She got up at 5:30 every morning and took care of Chip. She talked with anyone who came to see her, even when she could barely stand. Near the end of the ride, her back hurt so much that she could not swing her leg into the stirrup and would have to climb on the tailgate to get onto Chip. She never quit. Every time a soldier would come to meet her, she would dismount, shake their hand, and say, "Thank you for your service, and thank you for my freedom." Many times she would be approached by a Vietnam vet who had driven to see her. Often that vet, so overwhelmed, could barely get their name out before losing their composure. Falling to their knees and sob, "Thank you," or "I finally feel home," one such soldier comes to mind. We were riding through Invergrove Heights with the entire Dakota Mounted Patrol, and we stopped at the VFW for liquid for horse and rider. A man came out to see Elise on her horse, walked over to her, touched her leg, and literally started to bawl. He wanted so badly to thank her, but he could not control himself. His wife hugged him and told him that it was okay. Elise dismounted, went over to the man, shook his hand, saying thank you. She stood there and let that soldier have his time with her without words. I told Elise at the beginning of the ride that there are many Vietnam vets who have never come home or felt the thanks of a nation. I said that she may be the one person who could heal a wounded soldier and bring him home. Sorry. I know that for a fact. I have seen and felt what one little girl can do by riding the state. Sheriff, police, posse, or officer that Elise rode with would thank her for riding. They had been in the service, or a picture of a son or daughter in harm's way would come out of a wallet. You're riding for my son, my daughter, my brother, my sister. The house we stopped at where Elise thanked a mother for the ultimate sacrifice given, a beloved son. That mother hugged her and thanked her for riding for her son. She knew that even though we never met her son, we cared and were grateful. Many times the windshield wipers would run in my truck on a bright sunny day from the stories heard and held in my heart, and Elise rode on. Please, from a mother who has heard the story and felt the love of this state for the men and women who write that check for us to live free, Bill Durant. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Madden. Appreciate that. Questions or comments, committee members?
Sorry.
Representative Detmer.
Well, you could call me Representative Magnus, too.
Not talking.
But what was your, Mr. Chairman and Elsie, what was your favorite experience at Camp Ripley?
Okay, so they have these new simulators that teach you how to use handguns, and I always thought they were really cool. But they really hurt because they have a recoil. But and I got to take a friend with that I met on this ride, and I got a sticker there. And it was so much fun, but it hurt so bad. We had bruises, and they were telling us to lash and load, and it was so much fun. And I have a new friend, Sergeant Sewell. He was just deployed, and he was the funniest person, and he made it just an awesome time. And he gave us all private tours, and it was so much fun.
Mr. Chairman, and just a comment, probably these experiences that you've experienced really prove to show that many of our servicemen and women need that welcome home hug sometimes. And many times if they don't have close family members to do that, it's good to see that it's done by other people in our state and in our communities. So thank you for what you've just done.
Okay, anything further, members? All right, anybody from the audience who wishes to testify for or against? Okay. Well, thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time and consideration.
All right, thank you. And
thank you.
Thank you to both of you, too. We really appreciate it.
It was a honor.
Good. Oh, Representative Stevens. Oh, okay. Okay, I think we're ready to... Representative Severson renews his motion that House File 1884 be passed with recommendation referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Okay, House File 1880, Representative Severson. And it sounds like we need to be out of this room at 10 o'clock, but that gives us pretty close to a half hour in. Welcome to your committee, Representative Severson, and would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move that House File 1880 be approved and be forwarded to the Committee on Agriculture and
Rural Economy
and Veterans Affairs.
All right. Thank you, Representative Severson. Go ahead and present your bill.
Could I get a page to hand? This is a bill that we've had in the past. I think the last time we had the version on this, in particular, we asked for a veteran's preference and kind of a review of the veteran's preference. In fact, when we did that, we asked that a veteran, when they were going up for a job, would get a strong preference. So let me give a little background on the whole veteran's preference issue from my perspective, and that the previous bill was pretty fitting in that it kind of prepared the way for what I want to speak to right now, and that is in 1975, we had a very strong veteran's preference that basically was on the point system, and it said that if an individual who is a veteran applied for a job, they got either a 5 or a 10 point advantage based on the current, on that existing hiring system that was based on a point basis. And if they indeed had the number of points that were as an advantage over the other individuals, they were required to be hired. There was a strong veteran's preference, and there was a purpose for that. In 1975, we changed that, and we got rid of that tool that was actually helping our veterans get employed when they came back, and in my estimation, it was the result of an unpopular war, and it was a follow-on policy of what transpired to a lot of our warriors as they came back and were not thanked for the service that they had performed for their country, and it was an unfortunate issue. And so here we are today, we're looking at a policy which has gone from the point system, which is no longer really utilized extensively in either local or state government, to a resume system in which many of our veterans no longer have any advantage when it comes to veterans' preference. In fact, the way it's currently written is that an individual who goes in and puts down veterans' preference doesn't even get guaranteed an interview. And so that's what this bill does. I've got a handout that you've just received, and as a result of the bill last year, because there was some resistance from some of the administration, Department of Employee Relations, and some of the other human resource agencies, we came together with a compromise provision that put a study forth and said, what kind of numbers are we really looking at in terms of government, and particularly agency manning by veterans? And what we're seeing is, if you take a look at this handout, members, excuse me, you'll see that in virtually every department, the number of veterans that are now employed in those departments is on a significant decrease. And I would put before this committee that is in direct result of our veterans' preference policies that we have currently enacted. So what this policy does is it allows for an individual who meets the minimum criteria for that particular position requires that they at least have an interview. It doesn't require that the individual be hired. It merely requires that the individual has an interview. And there are a couple other provisions to this bill. The second provision basically puts a repealer on one of the issues that is available to all other civil servants except veterans, and that is for the right of a hearing if they are going to be fired. And then the reporting requirement is on the third portion of the bill. Basically goes to each of the agencies saying, if you have individuals that are requesting, are coming before you for hiring, that you have to make note of that, and they need to keep some statistical data, which basically goes to the handout that I've given you, members, that we're trying to reverse this trend. We're not going to quota systems, but we're trying to get some reporting on this that basically says the number of individuals that are coming before that particular department, how many of those individuals are hired, and give us some kind of feeler on where we may have some problems in the employment side. Now, members, I want to go back a little bit to the issue of actually being hired and what the results were. And I think, you know, when we have individuals back in Vietnam, there was compulsory service, mandatory service, and we had people that were being drafted against their will sometimes, and they were serving, and they were coming back after having served in an extremely intense environment to a place where they were not necessarily welcome. And one of the most important things we know as a society now is that one of the major things that you need when you come back is meaningful employment. Employment in a place where you can actually get your feet back on the ground and begin to readjust. In fact, some of the things that we're experiencing now with our men and women that are coming back from deployment who are having marital problems are based in the finances. And those finances are because they have come back and because civilian companies understand that that individual may get deployed again. They may put him in a job that is a lesser position. That creates some additional stress. And in the particular instance that we have here in the state today, is that we don't even give them the opportunity for a state job or a local job based on the preference that veterans got previous to 1975. So if we're asking the state, if we are asking these individuals to serve, and we're asking the citizenry, the private sector jobs, that they have to give these jobs back to these individuals, and then the state is refusing to give any kind of preference to these individuals when they come back, the state is, number one, it's not leading the way, but it's actually working in the opposite direction. We are not supporting those individuals. More importantly, these individuals are volunteering, taking a year out of their life to go. In many instances, they are disrupting their businesses, of whom they are primary owners in this thing, and then coming back to a failed business and now looking for another job to get meaningful employment, set feet back on the ground. And we are saying, don't come to the state or don't come to local government for that help, because we're not going to do that. That may seem extreme, members, but that's, you know, when you've got individuals who have put their lives on the line, they're coming back. We do not want the same reenactment of what transpired after Vietnam. And this is one step in the direction of reversing the impact that we had on those individuals. And I had one agency in my office yesterday, and we were talking about this because that particular agency wanted to be exempt from this provision. And I began to lay it out, and I said, you know what, if we had this policy in Vietnam, I think 15, 20, 30% of those individuals who are now living under bridges because they emotionally couldn't handle the stress, we needed to give them a job so that they could get on their feet, that were financially independent, and they could move on with their lives. Had we had that, I think we could have 10, 20, 30% of those individuals now leading meaningful lives and having fulfilled their dreams. But because we did this in 1975, we did this, and we undermined their ability to recover from a traumatic situation, we are responsible for those individuals today. We at the Capitol have a kind of a process in which we go through. We say, you know, for every dollar we spend, we can save five over here. I believe that if we would have had this policy in place back then, not done that deed that we did in 1975, that we could have saved millions and millions of dollars. More important, we could have saved hundreds of lives from the devastation. And so, members, this is not a monumental step forward. I've come to a compromise that basically said all we're asking for is an interview. All we're asking for is an interview. Get them in front of the individual. And then the other provisions basically give them the same rights that other civil service members have. And then keeping some numbers on the statistics for the particular department. And at this point, Mr. Chair, I'd open for questions. We have a testifier here as well.
Let's go to the testifier first. And welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Lieutenant Anderson. I served with Minnesota National Guard for 22 months in Iraq. And while I was there, I decided to continue my service, public service, with about 6 months to go on my tour after we'd been extended. I decided to apply for positions at the state level, and I did. I applied for numerous positions, and I did not receive any feedback. At the same time, I decided to apply for some federal positions, and I did get some feedback from the federal government. Within 6 months or so of returning home, I was employed by the federal government, and that's where I am today. And I feel that I would have been a state employee had I given the chance to even get an interview. I guess I'm here today to represent myself, but I'm employed already. I guess I'm here more to represent the people that aren't employed, as I'm still an active member of the Minnesota National Guard, and I do see it monthly, the people that are not employed, that do want jobs. And they're all well-educated individuals. They bring a lot to the table, but they don't have the opportunity to even get in the door to get an interview. Among age groups 20 to 27 of veterans in Minnesota, the unemployment rate is approximately 12%, probably higher now due to the recent economic conditions. So I think this would definitely benefit a lot of soldiers that are still out there today in Minnesota. And I support this bill more than I would. Like the federal side, you actually guaranteed a job almost. On this side, we may differ a little bit between Representative Severson and myself, but this gives a veteran an opportunity to earn the job on his own merit. And that's what a veteran probably wants more than anything, is just to step in that door, meet with somebody face-to-face, and then actually get the opportunity to sell themselves. Veterans don't want things handed to them, and that's what I believe most of the veterans I talk to do want. Also, the state spends hundreds of millions of dollars on veterans every year. We're one of the first states to initiate the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program. Some of you might be familiar with that. Spend a lot of money on that. That's giving veterans stuff. This is giving veterans an opportunity to support them the rest of their lives, not just a handout for school funding or something along those lines that's just not going to last long term. This bill will keep them, working for an entire life and possibly a great career. They also have a lot to offer the state as far as the qualifications that a veteran brings. A lot of people think veteran, they think broken individual and disgruntled, and they're just, the state's just thinking, well, we'll just put them in. We're not going to rehab these people and use this at the expense of the state. Most veterans that come back do not have PTSD or are not injured. They will bring a quality of worker to the state that cannot be brought from just a college graduate. So I would love to see this pass and just give veterans an opportunity, because I know that other states, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Minnesota, or Iowa, the surrounding areas all have this. The federal government has it. The counties and cities have it. Why doesn't the state have it? That's all I got to say.
Okay, thank you. We have a list going. Representative Dadmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, sir. Talking to some of your other soldiers in your unit, do you hear the talk of where soldiers feel that as soon as the possible employee or employer, I should say, finds out that they are in the Guard or the Reserve, that they kind of shy away from maybe bringing somebody on a job? Do you see that sometimes?
I do see that, especially in the blue-collar trade, with people that are taking jobs in construction or auto mechanics or stuff like that. They don't really want to hire them. It is, and I see it working at the VA. I have veterans come in all the time that talk to me about that. And they definitely would like their employer to support them. And how, as a state, can we enforce these rules to these private organizations and tell them that they need to keep these employees on when the state doesn't even give a veteran an opportunity to begin with? That's what I always question.
Thank you.
Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Representative Severson, I think I certainly agree with your goal here, 100%. And my question or concern is that whether this is the right way to get there or not, I guess. So I actually have several questions. Let me start by saying the report that you're asking for, how different is that from the one that we were handed out? And do we have a report like this going back further than 2004? If we do, I'd like to see that. And the reason why is because if the last time there was a change was 1975, the problem might not be the policy. The problem might be the administration that is running things. Is why I'm wondering if there is a report older than this that I could see. But start with, I guess, the question on how different is this from what you're asking for.
Mr. Chair and Representative Powell, thanks for the question. There have been no measurements that have been continually taken. That's part of the problem. When we put this study into effect, we basically looked back to 2004, and that was the mandate going back just several years to kind of get a sampling. The study that is outlined in this bill basically continues this study on an ongoing basis so we can continue to keep the trends up to date to find out where we're at and at least establish. You've got to understand that there was no appetite for doing this previous to this. And so that's part of the problem, is that we have just kind of turned our backs on this whole situation. And now it's time to turn around and say, you know what, this is an issue. The state government, particularly for the units that are deploying and coming back and trying to get jobs, for those individuals, we have an obligation to make it friendly for them when they come back. And if it's tough in the private sector, and it's non-existent in the state and local governments, we have an obligation to lead the way. We need to change that.
Okay, Representative Fowles.
Yeah, thank you. I really don't have a problem with the survey. I think that's fine. I do have a question, though, also on the requiring the interviews. With the Bush economy the way it is right now, we're hearing of people that have 20, 30 openings and they're getting thousands of applications. You know, if we have, 100 or 200 veterans apply, it's going to be very, very difficult to interview that many people. And so I'm wondering if we're better off to have, at least so many or a percentage of the total applicants or something like that rather than just every single one. Because I'm afraid that sometimes it's going to be a very large burden for the people that have to do those interviews. Is that an issue, or aren't you concerned about that? Or
Mr. Chair and Representative Faust, I think that's a valid question. That was one of the agencies that came to my office yesterday were kind of in that frame of mind. But let me go back to the issue of the sacrifices that these individuals are making, and we have. We have people who have taken time out of their lives. They've made a sacrifice. And this goes way beyond and what our testifier was talking about here, where the federal side requires you to hire them, which would mean that all of those other individuals wouldn't even get an opportunity at it. This just gives them the opportunity to have that interview. It may create some additional burden for the particular agency, but the bottom line is these individuals have paid the price for that interview. And so that's kind of the justification, I think, on that. I think the agencies, they're going to make it work.
Okay. Say, a reminder to everyone, we have one more testifier on the list at least, and we have to be out in about 8 minutes. So, okay. Representative Fowles.
I'll try to make it quick. I can live with that, too. I mean, I understand that there's going to be a little bit of a problem there, but I won't disagree with you on that point. I guess I do have to also ask, though. I mean, I've gone to interviews for job offers, or job possibilities to Idaho and different places, and sometimes you wonder whether, well, am I just here because I have to be or not? And I'm concerned that if we are in a situation where we're getting hundreds of veterans applying for jobs when there's two or three openings, and they're called to one interview after another, after another, after another, when not because they're not qualified, but just because of the sheer number that we're interviewing for one or two openings, that it may become very discouraging to them to just go to one interview after another, and rather than, you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
And I don't want that to happen either.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if, doing it the way the federal government is doing, or doing it the way we did prior to 75 or something like that, might be better just to skip to that step instead of going through this on the way there.
Representative.
And I don't know if that was a question or a comment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Foss, I tried that last year. Didn't work.
Fair enough.
Okay, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Severson, I think we're on the right track here. I think the Lieutenant said it very well. This will give people a chance to show what they can do on their own merits. The first reporting requirement that you have here is the total number of persons employed in full-time positions. And on the handout we have, that's the one thing that's missing. And I think that would be very useful for us to see what the true trend is, because some of these departments probably have fewer, some have more. So I would like to see that information if that's possible.
Okay.
But again, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Just a quick statement. And when our economy turns around, we're going to have a lot of jobs out there, and we'll have some qualified applicants for those jobs. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kaiser, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jerry Kaiser. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. Of many of the veterans organizations in the state of Minnesota, we wholeheartedly support this. And as a Vietnam veteran, coming back from the service in 1973-74, looking for a job in the Minnesota community, they weren't there. They didn't want me. And so that's fine. I went on and did other things. I would say in answering the question about the interviews, you know, the computer looks at all these people's interviews on the computer. That's what they use. And all we're asking is if a veteran has checked, and at least you get that interview. Now, that interview actually can be done on the phone. They all have to meet the minimum requirements of what that particular agency is looking for, and that might be a way to do it too, and at least they'd be able to get in the door to have somebody call. We had one gentleman, he was a lieutenant with John that just testified. He applied for many agencies in the state of Minnesota after serving 22 months. Not one of them even responded with a phone call saying, here's a guy who was a good, talented guy. Now, he did get hired eventually by the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, Military Affairs, where he's one of their people working for them. So it did work out for him, but we in the Veterans Committee want to at least have the opportunity, to have them have the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. We got, 4 minutes? I'm going to offer if anybody else from the audience would like to speak for or against. Okay.
I have it. And Mr. Chair, I think I have an author's amendment here too. I need to put into this, and if I could, because it is no longer a Department of Administration, it's the Office of Management and Budgeting. Minnesota Management. Yeah, it's in Minnesota.
Which line are you on, Representative?
Where is that?
Instead of Administration. 2.7.
Okay, Department of Finance. And Mr. Chair, on line 2.7.
Okay.
Just an oral amendment to that would be the Commissioner of Department of Finance, and strike Administration and insert Department of Finance.
Okay. Did everybody understand the oral amendment? Okay, any discussion? All in favor of Representative Seaver's oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner from the Minnesota Management and Budget Department. I've also been a state employee for about 37 years. I know that you're really rushed for time, and I have about probably 15 minutes of testimony, so I'll go through this as fast as I possibly can, and if it's possible for me to come back, I would certainly welcome that opportunity. And I also want to apologize to Representative Severson. I've never met him, and I was given this information yesterday. I was unaware of the hearing this morning, but I do feel comfortable enough to be able to bring some concerns that I think are important for this committee to be aware of. The first I would like to say, though, that...
Before you go on, I appreciate that you're going to shorten your testimony, and this bill is going to be referred to Representative Otremba's committee, and there will be another opportunity to testify there also.
Okay, do you want me to wait, or what would you prefer?
Committee, would you like to hear a little bit of what he has to say? Yeah, and this is a policy committee, so if you can try and speak to the policy things and keep it short, we really need to be out of here.
Okay, first of all, in response to a couple of comments that were made by Representative Severson, there has never been, to my knowledge, any component in our hiring system where it was mandatory that we hired a veteran, as it was referenced in 1974. During that period of time, veterans were, we had a scoring system, and if you were a veteran, you received 5 points. And those 5 points, depending on what category that you were in, those additional 5 points gave you that opportunity for elevated status in that consideration. But there has never been where it was a mandatory requirement that we hire anyone under those circumstances. The other is I also know that, and I would like to say that on behalf of the state of Minnesota, I think we've done an outstanding job in our ability to recruit veterans and the benefit sets and the things that we provide for veterans. And about 5 years ago, I represented the state at a military affairs function and received the honorary distinction from that organization on what the state does in response to its veterans. But the 2 points that I want to share with you is the interview. We are a merit-based system with the state of Minnesota, and what merit-based system means is that all citizens of the state can apply for the state job, and regardless of who you are, if you're a citizen of this state. And our selection process is based on job know-how, skills, and responsibilities. Everyone has this opportunity to do that. And what we have in our system is we have certain elevated status for certain categories, for women, for minorities, and also for people with disabilities. What we have in everyone is on what I would consider to be an even playing ground, but it's more in the area of the affordability if an employee is, if an individual is not selected for this. What this bill would do is it would require an interview, and I, the representative here that commented about would this just be a pro forma process also raises concerns for us as well. Currently, right now, if we do not, if we have an opportunity for hiring someone that we consider protected class status, an agency has to justify why they didn't hire that person. What happens for veterans, if a person is a veteran that applies for a state job, regardless of the 5 points anymore, since we no longer have that, we automatically refer that name to that agency. They're automatically referred to that agency. So that's the concern that I have right now by requiring the interview. And then the second one is the veterans' preference hearing. Currently, right now, the state is exempt from that, but I can tell you why, and that is that 90% of our population is represented by labor unions. The other 10% are in positions that are not eligible to be represented by labor union, like myself as an assistant commissioner, agency head, deputies, and so on. And the reason that we have been exempted by that is how complicated our system is. We are not a local city or county or municipality to that effect. A veteran's preference hearing would apply to, as I talk to my colleagues, currently right now, a veteran's preference hearing requires that the employee has a tripartite panel for which there's a neutral, which there's an individual that's appointed by the veteran and as well from the agencies. During that period of time, they're on full payroll and benefit status during that period of time. There are significant costs associated with that, and we currently have a system in place for the resolution of disputes by the labor unions with arbitration. So this gives us a pause, in a sense, because we'd have an election of remedies. You'd have someone that was removed from their job, and this would also apply to layoffs or any type of job action. And as a result of that, they could either go through their union or they could go through their veterans preference hearing. And so I have some concerns about the election of remedies during this period of time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
In light of the constraints on the time, this bill is nothing new. This is something we've had the last biennium, and they were in this, and this is significantly reduced. I'm a little irritated that the department did not come to me previously. I know this bill came and you gave us a hearing right after it was introduced. But this is not something that's been done in the dark. I will commit to this committee that I will get together with the department. We will have this discussion before it comes to Representative Chair Otremba's committee. And we, if there are amendments that need to be required at that point, we'll bring that forth. But I want to go on record as basically saying this is not done in the dark. This has been open. If the department had some problems with this before, they should have come to my office with this. And I have some odds with some of the you know, the statements that have been made here, but I'd be happy to discuss that in my office with the department. And I would ask for your support on the bill. We'll get it out of here and we'll work on it.
Okay, that sounds great. It's from the department. Okay.
Well, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, you're willing to meet with residents.
Sure.
Okay, good. We're really out of time unless there's something really pressing. Okay. Good. Representative Severson renews his motion that House File 1880 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And members, this is our...